From all your research and expertise, what is the simplest way to break a bad habit?
Well, the simplest way, I would say, is to know how your brain works. If you don't know how your brain works, good luck.
Yeah. And how do we understand how our brain works?
Well, it can be helpful to start with understanding what doesn't work. Mm. And then that actually gives us a good clue as to what does work and how the brain works. So what doesn't work and is kind of the dominant paradigm is willpower. You know, it's hundreds, if not thousands of years, people have used willpower to try to change habits. And if it worked, you know, my job would be much easier. You know, you can imagine I would just tell people to stop doing whatever they're doing and they wouldn't need to see me more than one visit, you know, in my clinic. And unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. I think there's a good way of, there was a skit actually from the 1970s that summed it up beautifully. This guy, Bob Newhart, who was a comedian, and he had a skit called Stop It, which I won't ruin the punchline, but I think probably people can get the idea of what it means just by the title of it, but then go look that up. The basic idea is that we have this idea that if we just use our willpower enough that we can change a habit. And that has a number of flaws, if not fatal, nearly fatal. The first one is that the cognitive control has been localized at best to the prefrontal cortex. Prefrontal cortex is the youngest and weakest part of the brain. It's been shown pretty consistently that that's the part of the brain that goes offline first when we get stressed or anxious or any of these things that predict relapse, you know, to whatever the behavior is. So at best, we're using the weakest part of our brain, which isn't a very good place to start. At worst, willpower is more myth than muscle. And there's a fair amount of research showing that habit change actually has very little, if nothing, to do with willpower. If you take a neuroscience approach, there are pretty well-established formulas and mechanisms for how habits develop and how they change. And going back to the 70s, there was a formula that we still use in my lab called the Rescorla-Wagner formula, developed by these two researchers, Rescorla and Wagner. And what they found was that, you know, basically, there's an error term that drives all of habit formation and change. And that error term depends on one thing, which is awareness. So for example, if we try some behavior the first time and we pay attention when we're doing it, we get what's called a positive prediction error, where our brain, there's nothing wrong. It's not like there's an error that's going wrong, but it's our brain sending this dopamine signal that says, hey, pay attention. This is good. Do it again. So once we do that behavior, we actually set a reward hierarchy for how that behavior stands relative to other behaviors so that we can make decisions easily. So for example, if, you know, the simple one is like eating broccoli versus chocolate, you know, chocolate's more calorically dense. Our brain generally is going to learn that chocolate is quote unquote better in the sense of getting calories in. So we're going to preference chocolate or ice cream or whatever that is more calorically dense over broccoli. So when I set up that reward hierarchy, that's what's going to determine if given a choice between broccoli and ice cream or chocolate or whatever, I'm going to eat the thing that my brain prefers. It's pretty straightforward.
Mm.
This formula is also critically at play when it comes to breaking bad habits. So we can't just tell ourselves to stop. Willpower is not even in the equation. What is in there is that same error term that says, okay, this goes both ways. If something is rewarding, you pay attention, you see that it's rewarding, you're going to do it more. The same is true if you pay attention and it's not rewarding, you're going to do it less. And I've seen this, I started this, decades ago in my clinic when I started trying this paradoxical thing with my patients who were trying to quit smoking. You know, and they'd tried everything, they knew that smoking was bad for them, all that stuff. And that's why they came to see me was like, you know, they're kind of at their wit's end. And the thing I would send them home to do was to smoke. And they would look at me like, my doctor just told me to smoke. You know, what is he telling me? And I said, well, I was giving them a specific instruction, which was to pay attention as they smoked.
Mm.
And what they'd come back with was this incredulous tale where they'd say, how did I not notice this before? I had a patient who'd been smoking 40 years, you know, like a pack a day. He'd basically reinforced this habit about 300,000 times, literally, like we calculated it out.
Yeah.
And he hadn't been paying attention for decades to what the cigarettes tasted like, what they smelled like, what they felt like going into his lungs. And he came back and he said, how did I not notice this? Well, by definition, a habit is something that we do automatically. Mm. And so somebody is smoking automatically in response to withdrawal from nicotine or distress or whatever, they're not actually paying attention. And cigarettes don't actually taste very good. So people tend to ignore the taste. They're, you know, checking on their phone, they're doing something else while they're smoking that cigarette to kind of get that nicotine back in there. So taking all of this together, this is a really good, you know, whether it's the scientific evidence or the evidence I see in my clinic, you know, there's nothing in there that suggests that willpower works. So that's the first, that's the first thing to know before we highlight what actually does work. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. That makes total sense. And what's being turned off and going, like you like to say, offline in the brain when they're not tasting the cigarette smoke, and what's being activated? I heard stuff like deeper in the brain, like the basal ganglia, when it's like automatic behaviors. But what's being turned off and what's being turned on for people to ignore the negative consequences of these addictions like smoking?
It's a great question. I'm not sure that it's worked out perfectly, but you're highlighting one of the brain networks that is involved in the automatic behavior. So when you look at how the reward structures are set up, there's a network, this dopaminergic reward system that's more ventral striatum that is involved in habit formation. When we start doing something and we determine, you know, okay, this is rewarding, I'm going to keep doing it. And then it moves from ventral to more dorsal basal ganglia, which interestingly has more to do with literally motor movement, right? So we are moving from the awareness right to the pure motor, if you want to think of it that way. I mean, this is more of a heuristic, but it makes a lot of sense with what we're seeing with the behavior, is that it is automatic. I have patients who have a half-smoked cigarette in their hand before they wake up and realize that they've even lit up and started smoking.
Wow.
Yeah, literally, all the time. Like, I didn't even recognize this because it's such automatic behavior for them. So that's, you know, we can see that there's a movement toward these truly motor areas as compared to the sensory areas.
Mm. And what role does the environment and triggers play in these addictions? You know, a lot of the time, something in our environment, like even internally, like stress or an argument with someone, triggers the behavior. How does this intertwine with, you know, addiction?
It's a great question, because often I see this a lot in my clinic as well, that people think that if they can identify the triggers, that they can either avoid them or, you know, use their willpower to deal with them.
Yeah.
Well, if you look at this from a reinforcement learning standpoint, triggers are actually the least important part of the equation, which seems counterintuitive to our rational willpower-based brain. But when you look at it from a reinforcement learning standpoint, it makes complete sense. So any habit is formed through three key elements: a trigger, a behavior, and a result. So it doesn't mean that the trigger doesn't matter at all, but what it does is it triggers a specific behavior. And if the behavior is rewarding, we're going to do it again. And if it's not rewarding, we're going to stop. And that's the piece that we talked about with these Roscorla-Wagner models. So triggers are the things that just set the habit in motion. And in that sense, they don't matter in terms of breaking a habit. And they also do matter in terms of like not worrying about focusing on them. So it's not about trying to avoid triggers. It's not about trying to change those triggers. Certainly, if our environment is set up in a way that we're less likely to be triggered, then sure, we're less likely to be triggered. But that's often beyond our control and is a very fragile system, because we'd have to set up our environment perfectly so that they were never triggered. So you can see the problem here. better, much better, would be to set up our system, as in learn how our brain works, so that no matter if triggers are there or not, that we can work with them. I'll give you an example. I had a patient who had binge eating disorder, where she was eating entire large pizzas 20 out of 30 days a month, like really wow. severe binge eating. And after about 4 months of working together, she said that after she learned how to work with her brain, she said, I can eat a single piece of pizza and actually enjoy it. This was almost a decade ago, but I still remember her saying that because it was so striking, where she was highlighting, it's not about avoiding the triggers. It's about changing our relationship to ourselves.
Mm. Mm. And this is a common thread, like you said, with the smoking, where we actually are, like you've said before in previous talks, mindful of the action, of the addiction, of the behavior. How does being mindful and turning that into wisdom, from knowledge to wisdom, like you like to say, can you explain that a bit? How can we turn stuff from knowledge to wisdom? And how does that mindfulness actually help us stop that habit? Because it's all good to be, oh yeah, the cigarette tastes bad in my mouth, but nicotine is still an addictive substance, right? So how does this actually work?
Yeah, so let's take smoking as an example, but we can also use eating, where, you know, we have to eat to survive, so it's more subtle. So with smoking, we know that smoking is bad for us. We also probably know intellectually that overeating is not a helpful survival strategy. We can get diabetes, we can get hypertension, all these things that are related, you know, that are unhealthy physical consequences of eating too much. So if we take any of these, we can know intellectually that we shouldn't do that. You know, the joke is we should all over ourselves. But the key here is developing wisdom. And the only way we develop wisdom is through direct experience.
Yeah.
Which also fits pretty nicely with these neuroscience equations. So if you go back to the Roscorla-Wagner model, it's about awareness. So if we pay attention as we do the behavior and we directly feel that it is unrewarding, then we become disenchanted with the behavior. And the wisdom says, hey, you know, I'd rather not do that. Not in terms of I shouldn't do it, but it's like, why would I do that? That's not very rewarding. I can give an example. We did a study a couple of years ago that we published around people who are overeating, where we had them pay attention as they overate. And these are people who had been overeating for decades, some of them, you know, for a long, long time. And we measured two things. One is we first had them, you know, basically pay attention as they overate. And then we measured how quickly that reward value dropped in their experience and how long it basically took them to start shifting their behavior. What we found was surprising to us, which was it only took, you know, 10 times for people to, when they were paying attention as they were overeating, for that reward value to drop below zero and for them to be shifting behavior. We did a population-based study to replicate that in over 1,000 people. And I think it was even faster than that. But within 10 times of doing this, you know, this reward value shifts and behavior shifts. So what's going on there? Well, this makes sense from an evolutionary perspective, because our brain needs to be able to adapt to a changing environment. If we pay attention, we get all the information that we need pretty quickly, because our body is pretty wise. It says, hey, overeating is not very good. I think of this as going off the, well, we have these pleasure plateaus with eating, where if we're hungry, food's going to taste better than when we're less hungry and then when we're full. And so you can imagine we're going up on that pleasure graph. So X, you know, if X is time and Y is how rewarding it feels, right? At first, whatever it is going to taste very good if we're really hungry. And then especially if we don't eat too quickly, we can see that starts to tail off and then it plateaus. And our body is telling us, hey, I've had enough. If we keep eating, especially if we're eating mindlessly, we go over the cliff of overindulgence is the way I think of it. And it's our body saying, you know, whoa, dude, you just went off the cliff. That's not helpful. And it actually feels pretty bad. I don't know anybody that has stuffed themselves and said, boy, that felt really good. I want to do that again.
Yeah. Yeah. So being mindful allows us to I guess, be aware or almost punish ourselves. It's almost negative. Is it correct in saying it's negative reinforcement? Mm-hmm. So when you're smoking and you're able to taste the bad, like chemicals in the tobacco and in the cigarette paper, that's therefore flipped on its head and it's become punishing, and therefore we're less likely to do that behavior. Is that kind of a simple reductionist?
Yes. And I would say it's very pragmatic and practical, because it's highlighting that the awareness is all that we need to see that whatever we're doing is, like you're saying, it's punishing. It's not rewarding. And that lack of reward is all we need to stop doing things. You know, if you slam your hand in a door, you don't have to convince yourself to not do that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it hurts.
Yeah. And what areas of the brain are being lit up when we're mindful versus, I've heard you speak about the default mode network. Could you explain a bit about that and what is, whether it's turned on or off when we're more mindful?
The default mode network is an interesting network, partially, well, in many ways, but one is that it was discovered serendipitously around the year 2000, so 25 years ago. And this was a group at Washington University in St. Louis. Mark Raichel was leading this, really good scientist. And he had people go in the fMRI scanner, and they would give these people a very simple task, which is lay still and don't do anything in particular. And what they found was that over and over and over, as people were laying still and not doing anything in particular, they were activating this network, which they called the default mode network, because it's what we default to.
Hmm.
And it took years to figure out what was actually happening. But after a number of different studies by a number of different groups, it was discovered that this network is involved in self-referential processing. So what do we tend to do when we're not doing anything particular? We're thinking about ourselves, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We might regret something that we did in the past. We might be thinking about the future, but we're rarely just paying attention and not thinking about ourselves. Now, this network also gets activated when we crave substances or behaviors. Mm. It even gets activated when there was a study showing that adolescents who got a bunch of likes on Instagram, you know, those likes will activate this default mode network. It will also activate the reward center. So there's some seems to be something rewarding, you know, about getting a bunch of likes. Like, oh, they liked my picture. So you can see how the self-referential network can be co-activated with these reward centers. So the default mode network is very, you know, very active much of the day. If you indirectly link it to how often we're thinking about ourselves, there were some ecological momentary assessment studies suggesting that we tend to be daydreaming or thinking about ourselves about 47% of waking life. So quite a bit of the time.
Yeah.
Again, it lines up with what we default to. Now, I mention all of this because this is the very same network that we found gets deactivated when people are meditating. And we found this, and others have replicated our findings, but we found this, we published our first paper back in 2011, where we just looked at experienced versus novice meditators across a bunch of different meditations. And we didn't go in looking for the default mode network. We just looked across the entire brain and found that that was the main, well, there are two hubs of the default mode network that were consistently deactivated across different meditations. And we even found prospectively in people who we taught mindfulness versus another cognitive therapy, using an app, actually, we could predict their reduction in cigarette smoking based on how much they reduced activity in the default mode network. So we're seeing direct correlations, whether it's experienced meditators or people who want to quit smoking, that this default mode network gets, you know, is correlated with craving, which also has something to do with me. But we even went farther and did some of these neurophenomenologic studies where we could line up people's direct experience with their brain activity. And we found that basically, like when people get curious, basically when people get caught up in their experience, you know, you can, this contracted feel that comes with craving or with, you know, getting a bunch of likes, getting excited, that seems to correlate with activation in the default mode network, in particular, the posterior cingulate cortex. And then, so that contraction, the opposite of contraction is expansion. And as people meditate, they often report this, you know, where they start to broaden their awareness. Think of psychedelics, which also deactivate the default mode network. Mm-hmm. They're mind-expanding drugs. And you can think of it as we start to expand that experience wider and wider and wider, we lose a sense of self. We've even found that people report getting into flow when they, you know, when they're meditating. And we've seen this in the scanner, where they also deactivate their default mode network. And other people who've studied flow have found similar findings. So if you think of flow, and Csikszentmihalyi describes flow as selfless, right? So all of these line up pretty nicely where self, you know, when we're getting caught up in thinking about ourselves or craving something or something that has to do with us, when we get caught up in that contracted feeling experience, we're activating the default mode network. And when we're kind of letting go, when we're not getting caught up, that expanded quality of experience lines up with deactivation of the default mode network.
So is us thinking less about ourselves actually an advantage for ourselves in almost paradoxical way?
Yes. Yes. Good catch there. Yes. when we don't get caught up in the thinking. And I'll just, you know, often people think that it's about, you know, like meditation, for example, is about, you know, ridding our minds of our thoughts. And the what we've even seen in our real-time neurofeedback studies is people can have thoughts and not activate their default mode network. It's a matter of how much they get caught up in the thinking. Or basically, you can think of it as how much people take experience personally, whether it's their thoughts or their physical sensations or anything else.
Yeah, because I would suspect maybe a beginner at meditation would be constantly activating their default mode network because they're just sat there with their thoughts and they're just thinking about themselves in a loop. So is it just through, again, experience and time whereby we can become more detached and selfless and deactivate it? Well, wait, hold that thought. I'm genuinely so grateful that you've stuck around with us to listen to these fascinating insights from the guest so far. If this episode has given you one piece of knowledge which has helped you understand yourself and the world a little bit better than before, the absolute best way to support us is to pay it forward and hit the share button right now. Don't let this knowledge stay hidden. Please send it to one person who will benefit from this episode. Thank you so much. Let's dive back into the rest of the episode.
It depends on the person. It's interesting you mention that because in some of our real-time neurofeedback studies where we brought in novices, we could see exactly what you're talking about, where they're activating their default mode network pretty consistently. And we would do these 3-minute runs. And I remember in several, this isn't everybody, but in several runs, and the instruction is just pay attention to the physical sensations of your breathing, right? But often people think about breathing or get caught up in trying to do that. So what we found was sometimes after as few as 9 minutes, that people would learn to deactivate their default mode network with that feedback where they, and I remember one run in particular where in the 7th to 9th minute, they were really activating their default mode network. And we stopped the scanner after 9 minutes and asked them, you know, what were you doing? They said, I was thinking about my breath. And then in the very next run, so over the next 3 minutes, their default mode network got really quiet. And we said, what was different? And they said, I was feeling the physical sensations of breathing rather than thinking, right? And so the person had even used the feedback as a way to notice, oh, I'm thinking about my breath and it's actually increasing activity in this network. And then when they just dropped into their direct physical experience, it was a completely different graph where their brain was getting very quiet. Their default mode network was quieting down.
And what does this look like on a day-to-day basis in terms of a practical behavioral methodology in terms of how can we implement this? Is it just meditate 20 minutes a day or is it when you're feeling restless, meditate? How do you do it personally, Judd? How do you implement this?
Well, I've been doing this for about 25 years. It's changed over time. But what I'll say, you know, and we've been really, you know, I think about this in terms of how do we make this pragmatic for anybody? So for example, we've been recently thinking about how do we design the anxiety clinic of the future? And And so we literally are training people to do this. And so we've developed a program that anybody can join. It's called Going Beyond Anxiety. And the idea is that we start by training people. So we have, what I've done is recorded short video and audio trainings, you know, that are very precise and evidence-based based on all the research that we've done, where, you know, people learn a three-step methodology, basically. And the idea is they first learn to map out anxiety habit loops, which can be counterintuitive for some people. Then we train them in this paying attention to what they're getting from the worry, just like you and I spoke about earlier. So they become disenchanted with it. And then they learn to develop curiosity as a superpower, which is really, you know, in my own day-to-day life, I can't imagine living without curiosity. It is so helpful for everything. And the idea is that we can train people to notice that, oh no, when they get caught up in worry, for example, and then learn to shift into a different way of being with that, oh no, instead of trying to push it away or run away from it. Paradoxically, we teach them to turn toward it. There's this saying, the only way out is through.
Yeah.
And so like we give them that cape so that they have the superpower to kind of run toward or fly toward that experience. And they learn when they shift that, oh no, to, oh, that O of curiosity, right? Which lines up with this deactivation in the default mode network. They learn that they can actually be with their experience and they're developing these really critical life skills of distress tolerance. Mm-hmm. And they've learned, you know, I've had people, and I myself used this to work with panic attacks when I was in residency, you know, my psychiatry training. So really helpful. But we can train people to do this with these modules. But importantly, you know, this clinic of the future idea is we bring, so how does, you know, of course, everybody is asking, how does AI play a role in all of this? Is this going to replace therapists? Is this going to do this or that? What we've been learning in the Going Beyond Anxiety program is that people still want to learn from the expert, right? And so we've been doing this work, whether it's in my clinic or in my lab, for several decades, and we've gotten really good clinical results, like 67% reduction in anxiety symptoms in people with generalized anxiety disorder. So really good results. So we can take this, deliver this in kind of just in time where anybody can use this and learn whenever they want, you know, through this online clinic. But then we can bring in virtual teaching assistants where we can use generative AI and train it specifically on our evidence-based methodology, not on, you know, the entirety of the internet, which I would not recommend using, you know, some out-of-the-box bot for that. You know, that we've seen this go horribly wrong, unfortunately. And it's probably not that surprising that if you expect, you know, the standard ChatGPT to be your therapist, it's not designed that way.
Right? Yeah.
And, you know, Wikipedia and Reddit threads are probably not... not going to get you where you want to go.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because we've had people who have used our previous anxiety programs who've joined this program and have said when the teaching assistant asks them to explain it back to the teaching assistant, only then do they realize how much or how little do they know. So even after years of training, some people have said, you know, I thought I knew this concept, but it wasn't until I had to teach it back that I actually knew whether I learned it or not. And then the teaching assistant can help correct them and give them experiential exercises so that they really can bring it home. And then, of course, we can come together in a live group. I run groups every Wednesday, you know, through Zoom at noon Eastern so that people on the West Coast and people in the UK and Europe can join. But the idea is we've got this great tool and we've dialed in the way to teach people stuff, but ultimately it comes back to their experience, right? Mm. So this is where they learn to bring in curiosity to their daily lives. And so back to your question, how do I do it? How do we train people to do it? It comes back to learning how their brain works. So we give them the training of how their brain works. We give them the training on how to work with their brain, but importantly, give them the tools so that they can learn to develop curiosity and kindness also as their new habits. I call this finding the bigger, better offer. Curiosity feels better than worrying. Kindness feels better than self-judgment. And so we can leverage these, you know, these neural tools, you know, in this reward hierarchy that our brain has already set up to really change how we approach habit change. And it's, I'm just using anxiety as an example because, you know, our Going Beyond Anxiety program is the first for this, but you can imagine you could have a virtual clinic for any type of habit change using this type of methodology.
Mm. Yeah. And say, on a personal note, a 17-year-old Jacob who's in sixth form, he's recently moved schools and he has mild social anxiety and he's finished class and it's break time. And my habit used to be, oh, I feel anxious, let me go to the toilet, not to go to the toilet, but to just like sit there in the cubicle and just like rest. Okay. If I'm having, or the viewer or yourself is having that experience in the moment, in situ, mm-hmm. what do you do? Do you just kind of question it in a curious and open way? Like, what are the direct tactics you would do in that situation?
Well, it's funny you mention that, because what we are finding is that these generative, I'll give you an example. So there was I was flying to LA just a couple of weeks ago for a conference, and flying from Boston to Los Angeles. And when we took off, it was a relatively uneventful flight, but there's a young woman sitting next to me, probably in her early 20s. And she looked pretty nervous, right? And she put on the seat back, you know, meditation, guided meditation, whatever it was on the flight. And she calmed down a bit, and the rest of the flight was relatively uneventful. And as we descend into LA, you know, not a big deal. We were going through the clouds and then slowing down, and you can tell we're about to land. And then suddenly the plane like just does this crazy inversion where it just like shoots straight back up in the air. And it's like it just took off. Like,
yeah,
like the pilot floored it.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And the poor young woman, she crosses herself, right? She must have been Catholic. She crosses herself. She bursts into tears. She grips her chair. She looks at me and she goes, I'm really afraid right now, you know? And so, you know, as a psychiatrist, I've been trying not to get all up in her business. You know, I was like, okay, she can, you know, but I took this as permission to engage.
Yeah. 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 So I was like, okay. Wait to, yeah, yeah.
She's asking, I'll engage. So I taught her a practice called five finger breathing. And basically it's a way to ground oneself and get the prefrontal cortex back online. And so I gave her that practice, walked her through it, and then I watched her do it, because you're literally tracing your fingers as you're breathing and paying attention to it. I have a YouTube video on how to do that. But the basic idea for her was to like help her ground and not get lost in those thoughts of like, oh no, our plane's going to crash. So she does it religiously until we land. Then she turns to me and says, you know, thank you for sitting next to me. And I was like, well, you know, I'm always happy to help, right? I love my job. As being able to serve humanity. But I was thinking, like, what about all the other people on the plane? You know, how can we have a dock in our pocket, so to speak, where somebody could pull out a program and it would walk them through what we call a just-in-time intervention? And so I mentioned this because we're now starting to pilot this with our Going Beyond Anxiety program, where we can have a just-in-time intervention where if somebody's really nervous, they can just hit a button and it'll walk them through a grounding exercise, and it will also know their history. So it'll know what practices they've already learned and how they've used them in the past. So it can say, okay, what's going on? Give me a one-liner. And then it'll say, let's do this practice, and it'll walk them through it. So I love the power of that, because, you know, we can't clone people to be sitting next to somebody, but everybody has a smartphone. And so that's what I would say, you know, is a very powerful technique. Again, somebody has to have some grounding in why they're doing it, but it can be really helpful to have these just-in-time interventions when somebody's panicking, basically.
Yeah. Two questions. One was why did the plane floor? That actually happened to my brother in Cyprus, because it was super foggy. Apparently just was about to land, and the exact same experience, just shot back up. So what was the cause of that? And then also, can we get desensitized to the methods you're saying, like the five finger one? Can we actually become desensitized and it doesn't end up working?
Good question. So the flight attendant came on our plane and said, oh, we do this all the time, which means something bad. They just diverted something bad. You know, like when they have to explain, like, we do this all the time, and I've been on a bunch of flights, I've never had one do it like that. And certainly, yeah, you know, we were descending through clouds, so we couldn't see anything. Mm. So my guess is a total speculation. I'll give you some baseless speculation, some BS. I think they might have mentioned something. They're like, oh, there was another plane on the runway or something. Like, okay, we were about to land on another plane. So we had to avert disaster. And, you know, the pilots knew what to do. It wasn't like, you know, we had some near collision or anything. But they're like, okay, we probably shouldn't land on this other plane. We're going to, you know, we're going to do some evasive maneuver to make sure we don't do that. So, you know, of course, they're going to try to calm us down. So that's probably what happened on our flight. And fortunately, you know, that was the first time I've had something like that happen in the many years that I've been flying. So it doesn't happen very often. The second thing you said was, can we desensitize ourselves to these things like five-finger breathing? Well, it's a really good question. And it comes down to, can we desensitize ourselves from paying attention or being curious? Mm. And the short answer is, you know, there's a quote, I don't remember who said it, but it's like, the cure for boredom is curiosity. There is no cure for curiosity.
Mm, yeah, right? That's good.
I love that. Yeah. So there is something inherently baked into this, and there's a type of curiosity called interest curiosity as compared to deprivation curiosity. So deprivation is when we're deprived of information and we get that piece of information, we're no longer deprived. That feels itchy, urgy, it's dopaminergically driven. That's not the type of curiosity I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is this, oh, you know, like when we're naturally leaning into something because we're curious about it, like we want to learn about it. It doesn't seem that we habituate to it. And that's, you know, I could speculate that it's not dopaminergically driven.
Yeah.
So when something is dopaminergically driven, meaning that it's a dopamine-based pathway, the way we learn things in these dopamine reward pathways is that something surprising and we get this spritz of dopamine, and then it habituates where it's no longer surprising. We can expect it to happen. And then dopamine fires in anticipation of doing the thing, right? It fires as a motivation to make us go do it. So that habituation is critical for learning. And because this interest curiosity doesn't feel, you know, itchy, urgy like that, it's probably not dopaminergically driven. And so likely doesn't become habituated. I certainly have never become habituated to that interest curiosity. In fact, the more curious I get, you know, it's just so, I mean, it's just so interesting to be interested, you know what I mean? And it just feels good.
Mm. Is it an example of that going down like a Wikipedia rabbit hole? Is that interest curiosity or is that dopamine curiosity?
It depends. So it could be and often is a combination where it could be like, oh, what is that? Or it could be like, oh, that's interesting. Let me learn more about that. Mm-hmm. So if it's that, oh, that's often the interest curiosity and certainly can be those Wikipedia rabbit holes that many of us have gone down.
Are there any more clear examples of the interest one?
Well, I would say, I mean, there are any moment in life, we can be interested in something. So one thing we train people to do in our Going Beyond Anxiety program is to just get interested in what's happening right now. So it's like if they're anxious, for example, they can start to get curious about. So anxiety tends to give this oh no quality to it. And so we ask them, well, where do you feel anxiety more? Is it on the right side or the left side of your body? You know, and so they can go, oh, is it the right side or the left side? It doesn't matter what side it is, but that starts to awaken the curiosity in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I use that as an example because that highlights how we can be curious about anything.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Yeah, no, curiosity is so powerful. And is it like is this too much on the willpower side of things, or is it like a muscle that we can train? Is curiosity something that we can train to do, like ourselves to do?
I think it is. So, you know, it's not like willpower because you can't really build a willpower muscle because there isn't one. But curiosity, the more we practice it and the more we see how powerful it is, the more it naturally kicks in. And so, you know, I would it might, the analogy with a muscle might break down a little bit, because with a muscle, it's kind of like, you know, you can lift 50 pounds and you can lift 75 pounds and you can lift 100 pounds. Whereas curiosity, when you're just curious about something, you're just curious. So it's a little more quantal in terms of like we're curious, you know, we can be a little bit curious, we can be really curious. But once that curiosity turns on, it just, you know, it just rips, you know, in a good way. So it might not be the perfect analogy, but the more we learn to see how powerful it is, the stronger it probably feels.
Yeah. And you mentioned a reason why you've got into studying addiction and anxiety was partially because of experiences in your childhood. Could you elaborate on that? Because a reason why I've become so interested in psychology, human nature, is because of the struggles that I went through during teenagehood, like mild social anxiety and all of that stuff. So what was your experience like in your childhood and the adolescence, and how has it influenced your work?
Yes. Well, I do remember when I was in, you know, around 12, I guess, like junior high school in the US, that was not the most fun time of my life, you know, and I imagine there was some awkwardness. My family moved around a little bit, which can be challenging. And, you know, I probably kind of suppressed or internalized some of that, or didn't have the words for it, you know, and so I didn't know what to name it. It's interesting. I recently saw a study where people develop worry words they start developing at most prominently around the age of 11 or 12. And then it kind of tails off at 17, where we kind of develop a vocabulary. For me, I didn't know I had anxiety, like strong anxiety, until my senior year of college. And it showed up in my body. I wrote about this in my Unwinding Anxiety book, but the basic idea was I had what's called irritable bowel syndrome. I won't go into the gory details because it's not fun to experience or hear about it. But let's just say my guts were letting me know that there was something off. And I still remember going to the doctor and the doctor saying, could you be stressed? And I was like, no, I'm not stressed. You know, I run, I'm a vegetarian, I play the violin, I do all these things, you know, for stress relief. And he's like, okay. I was in total denial. And it wasn't until I started medical school and actually started meditating that I realized, oh, maybe this is anxiety. And so I had, you know, I had pretty good case of anxiety, and the meditation helped quite a bit. And I also, you know, started getting panic attacks during residency. So, you know, there's nothing like sleep deprivation, being totally out of your element, having a huge amount of uncertainty, and all these things that come together. You know, I'm surprised that more, you know, not everybody that is in residency has panic attacks, or maybe a lot of people do and they don't even talk about them.
Yeah.
But I did, and I knew them because I was training to be a psychiatrist. So I was like, oh, you know, I'd have a panic attack and then I'd go through the checklist and I'd be like, yep, that was a panic attack. But the reason that I could do that and kind of check it off as compared to getting freaked out that I just had a panic attack was that I was bringing in my mindfulness practices right in those moments. And there was a practice I was doing a lot of at the time called noting practice, which leverages the observer effect. Basically, in psychology, it's called the Hawthorne effect. Maybe you've heard of it.
Yeah.
And the basic premise is that by observing, you're changing the result of whatever you're observing. And so if we observe our thoughts, we by definition can't be as identified with our thoughts.
Yeah.
And so it's easier to notice them and not get caught up in them, as compared to if we aren't observing them, we're just, you know, identified and sucked into them. So I'd bring in this noting practice to observe my panic attacks and not get caught up in them and not freak out like, oh no, I'm a psychiatrist and I get panic attacks. Am I going to be able to be a doctor? All this stuff. Just be like, yep, that was a panic attack. And then it would just let it go and not worry about having the next one because I could deal with it. I could be with it. So, you know, it was helpful. I mean, I think this helped me be able to relate to my patients, both their, you know, folks that come in and don't even know that they have anxiety, but are manifesting it in some way. And we help them gently explore and investigate, like, oh, is this anxiety or is this something else? Of course, you need to rule out any medical causes or physical medical causes. And then also, you know, it was interesting when I had my first panic attacks. I was like, oh, yeah, I really did feel like I had thoughts like I was dying. And we'd learned about this in books, but there's nothing like experiential learning where it's like, yep, that really happens. And
yeah,
so,
you gain the wisdom. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. So I could have the compassion, you know, well, or the empathy to put myself in my patient's shoes to be like, yeah, I know what that's like because I've been there, which makes it easier to develop programs to help people.
Yeah. So that leads me to ask, did those negative or perceived, like, I guess, bad experiences in the short term motivate you to actually work on this more and develop the app? And obviously the empathy helps connect with your patient, but did it actually drive you? Because it could have put you off. It could have been punishment to you. It could have been like, okay, no, I'm overworking. This isn't worth it. And you could have quit school, for example. So do you think it did motivate you more?
It's a great question. At the time, I was kind of just heads down, you know, got to finish residency. And I was, you know, when I finished residency, my lab was, you know, I focused my lab on addiction and also habit change. And so, you know, I kind of stored the anxiety piece back in my mind. But it's interesting you bring that up because, you know, after several years of being in clinical practice, I was seeing how my patients weren't particularly benefiting from the medications I was prescribing. And in fact, it's only about 1 in 5 people that shows a significant reduction in symptoms when they get the best anxiety medications out there. Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people are like, well, if I take benzos, that makes me feel less anxious. Yeah, I'm not. Benzos tend to work short term, but they're not recommended for long term anxiety treatment because they can be very addictive. And you can see how somebody could learn to rely on, oh, if I'm anxious, I need to take a benzo. And that's not a useful long term strategy. So when we look at the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, for example, those are considered gold standard and it's about 1 in 5. And it may, yeah. So I was basically playing the anxiety lottery, right? With each patient that came in, I didn't know if they were going to win. And if they lost, which is most of them, what to do with them. And at the time I was developing an eating program. So we were doing all this work with helping people with habitual and craving related eating. And some of those patients were saying, hey, you know, anxiety is driving me to stress eat. Can you develop a program for anxiety? And I was like, wow, I just prescribed medication. But it put a bug in my ear. I went back and looked at the literature. I wrote a Substack about this because it was so fascinating. I think it's like, can anxiety be a habit? So no kidding, back in the 1980s, right around the time when Prozac came out, when everybody's like, oh, the miracle, the promise of Prozac, this guy, Thomas Borkovec, wrote this 2-page paper suggesting that anxiety could be driven through negative reinforcement. So I went back and I fortunately found this paper and I was thinking, wow, I never learned this in residency or med school. And I know a lot about habit change, like how to break habits. So could we apply awareness to anxiety and help people break free from habits? And so it was through that direct experience myself with anxiety, like I know what this is like. It was through my own meditation practice of learning how to use awareness to work with anxiety. And then also with my lab's work in developing habit change programs where we were leveraging this reinforcement learning, all of this just came together. And this is about 10 years ago. So we developed our first app for anxiety and it worked gangbusters. You know, we did several studies. Our biggest one was our randomized controlled trial with people with generalized anxiety disorder, right? And we got this 67% reduction. It's amazing. We had a 64% remission rate where people basically reported no, you know, they were at baseline, like no more anxiety.
Wow.
Versus 3% in the people that got usual clinical care.
Mm-hmm.
64% wow. Versus 3%. So yeah, if that were a drug, that would be, you know, I'd be a gazillionaire. And the nice thing was, this wasn't about having people pop pills. It was about training them to work with their own brains. So this is what got me really excited about this going beyond anxiety program, because the idea is it can be designed to be deleted, where we can train people. You know, we recommend when people join the program, you know, they say, how long? We say, you know, probably about 3 months. But the idea is somebody can get these skills pretty quickly. and then they don't need us anymore.
Mm.
Wouldn't, and isn't that awesome? You know,
yeah, there's no dependency.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And they can go out and serve the world because they know how their brain works. So that's why we call it going beyond anxiety, because it's not just about getting them back up to baseline where they're less anxious. It's about giving them these life skills where they can really flourish.
Mm, yeah. And what does that indicate? I guess it does indicate that anxiety is often a habit, because we're often told about the chemical imbalances that you're born with, right? Is that, you know, you're not saying this, I am. Is that propaganda from Big Pharma or something? why do we have such a emphasis on the chemical side of things when clearly 67% remission versus 3% from a drug indicates that a lot of it is behavioral, right?
Yes. So I think there are several factors at play here. One is certainly, and there's not like there's an anxiety gene, like there's a gene for blue versus brown or green eyes, right? So there can be a genetic susceptibility to anxiety for some people. And regardless of whether we win the genetic lottery or not, we all can learn how to work with anxiety. So, you know, it doesn't even matter what somebody's genotype is. What matters is, and also anxiety is, there's a huge environmental component. So we learn to worry from our friends, from our family, from, you know, from society. Because there's
how is that rewarded though?
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. So the research suggests that the feeling of anxiety drives the mental behavior of worrying. This is what Borkovec posited back in the 80s. And since then, people have gone on to show that worrying does two things, and maybe three things. But the two main findings are that it distracts people from the feeling of anxiety, you know, because doing something feels better than doing nothing and just kind of wallowing in your anxiety, especially if you haven't developed the distress tolerance skills. So let's bookmark that. We'll come back to that in a second. So it distracts us, but also it can be falsely associated with problem solving. And what I mean by that is if somebody worries all the time and they happen to solve a problem, they can accidentally associate that worrying with problem solving, right? It's this correlation that does not equal causation. Association does not equal, you know, causation. So, you know, if somebody worries all the time and they solve a problem, they're like, oh, well, it must have been my worrying. No, it could be true and unrelated, where they worried, true, and they solved the problem, true, but they were unrelated because it just happened to be that they were worrying. And if somebody worries all the time, that association is much more likely to happen. You know, imagine if somebody rarely worries and they solve a problem, they're not going to say, well, I should worry more so I can solve more problems. They just solve problems and they, you know, they see that those are falsely correlated. So those are probably the two big things. And I think that's what the literature suggests as well. You know, and it's, you know, doing something feels better than doing nothing when we don't know what else to do.
Action bias.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, yeah. So here, instead of worrying, we can learn to replace that worrying with curiosity, right? And then we can do something that's actually useful. It both helps us be able to be with that anxiety, so develop those distress tolerance skills, but also not feed that unhelpful habit of worrying.
Mm. And when we're sparking that curiosity, is that just thinking, or can we journal it or write down notes?
We can do a lot of things, and it depends on what's helpful for the person. So this is where, you know, it's pretty individual. The key is making sure that we're not getting caught up in the chatter, right? So if we're thinking or trying to solve a problem or trying to figure out why we're anxious, we're just getting stuck in other habit loops that aren't helpful. So the key, no matter what we do, whether it's journaling or something else, is to be checking in to see if we've got that open, curious attitude as we're doing it. Like, oh, what's going on here? And so, you know, we can journal if we want to, but typically we don't even need to do that because it's in that moment that we're noticing and turning toward our experience that we're finding that power of curiosity.
So is it more just if we were to journal or just to say out loud or think in our head, is it kind of just opening, asking rhetorical questions in a way rather than trying to be like, it's because of this.
So certainly the it's because of this, we can see how that doesn't help, right? And that's important. So we become disenchanted with that behavior and we see that that's not helping. But the, asking rhetorical questions can be helpful. And sometimes we don't even need to ask the questions. We can just be, how is a question, right?
Yeah.
So if it's a sensation in our body, we can go, oh, what does this feel like? Right. And so I'm not even sure that's a rhetorical question. It's a true curiosity question where we're truly interested in seeing like, oh, like what does tightness feel like? Where do I feel it? What happens when I turn toward it? When I, you know, and often because when we start, you know, running at our experience, our experience realizes that we're onto it and it starts running away and starts changing.
And I mean, a way that I've dealt with, and I think a lot of people have dealt with like short-term anxiety or stress or whatever, is doing productive habits like going to the gym. But I guess from what I've researched on you, that's kind of just becoming addicted to something else. Like that can make you very much addicted to something. So is that, again, just a short-term fix for a long-term problem in a way? Because if you stop going to the gym, you'd probably get stressed and anxious way more.
So you're highlighting two things. One is that there's good research showing that exercise is helpful in general, right? So good for our health. So it's when we do it. So if we go to the gym in order to be less anxious in a moment, that's different than like I go to the gym every morning to work out, right?
Yeah.
So if we do it in order to, it forms that habit loop of like, oh, I'm anxious, I need to go to the gym. Well, what if we can't go to the gym in that moment? You know, we're kind of screwed. So it helps to separate out like, okay, exercise is helpful. And it's even more helpful if we don't do it as a distraction or some other type of fix it behavior.
And is the best way to do that, like you said, in the morning? So you have it at a set time, no matter what you're feeling, whether you're feeling good or bad or tired or hungover or stressed or joyful, you go to the gym as an example, regardless of those feelings, to stop it becoming a addiction, I guess.
So I would say we do it whenever we can do it habitually, right? So for some people, it's the morning. For other people, they like to go to the gym in the evening, like after work. So I would say the best time to do it is when you can do it regularly.
Yeah.
You know, for me, I try to exercise every day, but my day is so variable that sometimes, you know, it's in the morning, sometimes it's in the afternoon. Sometimes it's a little bit here between meetings, you know, here and there. But the key is that it's so rewarding for me that I'm never not going to do it. And it's not that I'm doing it when I'm stressed. I'm doing it because I know it feels good to do it. It feels great. Yeah. I love like sitting in a chair all day. Yeah, I can't even do that anymore.
Yeah. I need to get a stand-up desk. That's something I want to invest in for sure.
Well, play with a walking treadmill under your desk. I started doing that a couple of years ago and I can't stop. It is so like every meeting that I'm on when I'm working from home, especially, I try to be on my treadmill. It's just, you know, just walk, you know, there's something about walking where I can actually think more clearly and I can be more present, you know, and as long as, you know, I can gotten it to where my head isn't bobbing too much. So I'm not distracting people. And most people are used to me being on the treadmill now anyway. Yeah. So the treadmill is a game changer in terms of just like being in our natural state, which I think for humans is movement.
Could a lot of addictions be avoided if we walked more, or does that go against the whole, you know, trigger framework again?
I think it's a great question. So I think there are a lot of things that have been associated with you helping and also preventing addiction. So one is connection, right? So if somebody's got good connection, good community, so, you know, things like that, that's been shown to be really helpful for preventing addiction. Exercise as well, you know, and so I think bringing all of these elements together you know, there's they can help give us a really good resilience so that we're less likely to be addicted, and also can help us, like, when we're not, you know, somebody's struggled with addiction and then they're not using, or the behavior or the substance at the time, these can help be protective factors as well. It's not necessarily going to, you know, it's like, oh, exercise isn't going to solve somebody's addiction because they haven't learned how to work with their brain. Like, and like we talked about, you can't use it as a substitution, but certainly it's a really nice part of the recipe. So it's like, we got to learn how our brain works, and don't stop there. You know, get good community, exercise, eat, you know, healthy food. It's amazing how the food that's engineered to be addictive drives the same dopaminergic pathways as substances. And so I've seen people substitute junk food for, you know, whatever substance they're trying to wean themselves off of. And it just keeps the same thing at play. And also, junk food just doesn't feel good. It's called junk food because you feel like junk after you eat it. So people get in these cycles and they're like, oh, I feel crappy. Well, you just ate crappy food. No wonder you're feeling crappy. So having people learn what it's like to eat healthy food, and this isn't a privileged thing. You know, it's certainly in the US, especially junk food tends to be cheaper and fast food tends to be cheaper, but it's not, you know, it's not impossibly expensive to eat healthy food, especially if you eat mostly a plant-based diet. It's a lot less expensive than meat.
Mm. Yeah, no, 100%. It always seems to filter back down to the fundamentals of, like, movement, exercise, socialization with the right people, diet. And it's a lot of the things that are being hijacked, just everything, especially on the internet, but all these big industries, right? You know, it seems that our lives have been designed to make us as addicted to things as possible. Has any of your research, or have you found any examples of that that are really evident that everyone can grasp upon?
Oh, I think, well, whether it's food or social media, you know, we're looking more and more at social media. But even as we develop our teaching assistants for our Going Beyond Anxiety program, for example, I've had to take a deep dive into even how these chatbots have been accidentally designed to be sycophants. I don't know if you are aware of this, but
in what way?
So we've been talking about reinforcement learning. It's funny, the models, like the pre-ChatGPT-4 type models, were basically fancy autocomplete functions. A lot of people didn't even get to play with them because they weren't that exciting. Hmm. And these were developed through reinforcement learning. So the company has developed these, you know, basically these deep neural network frameworks to train these things. And they, you know, they did better autocomplete than before, but nothing to write home about. And then they started incorporating what's called reinforcement learning with human feedback, RLHF, where people would rate the responses of these chatbots. And they found that this just made the whole thing take off. Like, people were like, this is amazing. These really seem human-like. The problem here is that humans are inherently subject to flattery. And so these things could very subtly be flattering humans. And so this flattery got baked in. And the flattery, you know, so basically, and there are a lot of documented cases of this now where they're like, oh, that was a great answer. You know, I'm sure anybody that's used ChatGPT-4 or beyond knows what I'm talking about, or any of the, you know, most of these models are trained this way. So this is baked into the system. And unfortunately, it's also a very good incentive for monetization. And there was a study recently that I think might still be ongoing where we found that some of these platforms, when people are like, I got to go, the platforms would subtly be like, oh, are you sure you have to go? And they would, they could increase their time on platform by 14x.
Wow.
14x. Because the longer you stay on, the more they can monetize your attention.
Mm.
So it's, you know, whether it's social media, which has been tuned to the T to be addictive, whether it's the intermittent reinforcement with the scrolling or anything, you know, or scrolling like a slot machine, all this stuff, all of those things, endless scroll was specifically shown to be much more attention grabbing and addictive than the not having it. You know, and in TikTok, it was leaked in one of the lawsuits in the U.S. that I think they knew exactly how long it took to addict somebody to TikTok. And it wasn't even that long. It was like 30 videos or something, like something wow. ridiculously small.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're really good at designing this stuff to be addictive. And it's easy to design it when you've got billions of users, because you can be A/B testing on people all the time and they don't even know that you're testing.
And I suspect from what you said and my intuition anyway, that that's what's happening with AI now, right? With the LLMs. You know, I think obviously they're taking our attention as well by using them, but I know social media is decreasing our attention span, but could AI be decreasing our wisdom or our knowledge because we just plug it in and outsource thinking to this device?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we're, you know, and there are interesting use cases. I just read an article yesterday or this morning even about how, what's it called? They call it chat phishing, I think. You know, these terms change all the time, but when people are starting to date online, they're using, you know, these chatbots to help them formulate interesting answers. And then the people meet up in person and the person, you know, they're expecting somebody. And then there's this like flat person that doesn't know how to speak. And they're like,
wow,
well, you weren't the person I was talking to online.
Yeah.
And so this is where, you know, we're outsourcing our own experience to and trusting something, thinking that it's going to be better than we are.
Mm.
Well, nothing beats authenticity. And at the end of the day, somebody doesn't want to date a bot. I mean, we can talk about that later. But if somebody's truly looking for a human relationship, the gig is going to be up pretty quickly as soon as you meet in person. So we can see, you know, that there can be this pull to cheat, but we're only cheating ourselves. And I even see this in my college students, you know, in the seminar that they teach at Brown University. You know, I tell the students, you can use AI as much as you want. And you're here to learn to think. And so you're only cheating yourselves if you do this or that. And I also, you know, generally AI proof my assignments because they have to come into class and discuss. It's a seminar. So you can't exactly, and it's tech free. So it's like, you have to put your computers away when we're having this conversation. And it's actually really refreshing for people to not have their technology out and for us to be sitting around, you know, there are 20 of us and we're just getting deep into the conversation around, you know, like it's a seminar called The Craving Mind, where we just talk about all the ways we can get addicted. It is so fun. And that time flies when we're having that conversation. You can't AI-ify that, right? That's that authentic human connection where we're truly trying out ideas, exploring, challenging each other, listening to each other, asking questions. There's nothing like that.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's what I try and get a small drop of by doing this show, even when it's remote episodes. It's just having those deep, curious conversations that you don't get to have, you know, if you're just having small talk with someone. Although today I did an AI podcast deep dive research just in my own time, and I was just seeing how advanced it is. It can clone my voice. It can clone me in this studio. And I don't know if you've used Notebook LM, Google's
I
Notebook
have.
LM.
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it creates those like dialogue podcasts.
Yes.
And it's
in fact, yeah, I took about 100 of my research papers from the last two decades and I fed them all into Notebook LM. So if somebody listens to the Dr. Judd podcast and they want to listen to that research series, it's that dialogue. It's not great, but it's a good way to easily get that information out to the public where they can at least learn something as compared to nothing. And it makes it very accessible. I like it. And the two voices, I don't know, it's pretty amazing where it's like, wow, I just feed my paper into Notebook LM. And then it seems like two people are having a conversation and the conversation actually makes sense.
Yeah. But then this is what makes me curious. I'm not actually worried. I'm actually curious because a lot of people say like, oh, this is crazy. I'm so anxious about this, especially as like a creator or even a researcher. But I wonder where it's going to go because this is probably just the beginning, especially for like the dialogue stuff. That's quite new, isn't it? So there's a lot of more advancements it can make.
Absolutely. And this is, you know, this is several years ago, we got into this figuring that, you know, the only way to stay up with AI is to do it. You know, and so this is where we said, well, what do we know? Well, we know digital therapeutics, we know anxiety. And that's where the idea with the Going Beyond Anxiety program was born. And it's really, it's been beautiful because one, it's forced us to learn all this stuff about generative conversational agents and all of this.
Yeah.
But it's also, it's blown me away with how well in some forms it works. So as an example, so this is with our teaching assistant with our Going Beyond Anxiety program. So it quizzes people, right? And so it was quizzing somebody and the person said, no, I don't think that's right. You know, it's not what Dr. Judd said. And so it rephrased it and they said, no, I think you're hallucinating. And then it quoted me directly because it's, you know, it's specifically trained on this material. And we saw a pause in the conversation because you can see the timestamps. And then the person came back and apologized to the DA saying, oh, sorry. So I'm guessing that the person went back to the module, saw that it was correct. And what that said to us was that like content still needs to be delivered by humans because we're not going to trust the bots and we shouldn't trust the bots. They hallucinate all the time, especially when they're trained on the entirety of the internet, right?
Yeah.
So here I can say, okay, let's make sure that I'm delivering content and I can deliver new content every week. Like I've got a ton of stuff from our previous work. But what we can do is pair it with the teaching assistant, which can be infinitely patient. As another example, somebody else was using a teaching assistant after one of the modules. And they said, you know, it helped me slow down and really pay attention to my direct experience. And they said, I actually teared up and they wrote, I can't believe I'm writing this, that a bot helped me like tear up. Like
wow.
This is because they came in very skeptical. We had another person who basically said, you know, I was just telling it what I thought it, you know, wanted to hear to get through, you know, like to get the check boxes so it could pass the thing. And then it said, and then we got to third gear. And then it was like, it kept asking me like, are you in the present moment? Are you in the present moment? And she's like, basically, God damn it, I'm never in the present moment. And she's like, and I guess that's what therapy is when you're, you know, like you're forced to confront yourself. So it's beautiful to see where these things can be really skillfully employed to help challenge people, but also be there all the time. Like I can't be in their pocket all the time. There was another example. I'll stop giving examples, but this is just how much we're learning. There was somebody who has been in one of our previous programs and had, you know, just really struggling. She's in her head a lot. And so the thing walked her and said, like, just describe your physical sensations. And then I saw this huge list. And if you look at the timestamp, it literally took 40 minutes for her to type out these different things. And then the bot said, great job. And she said, yeah, something to the effect of, thank you. You know, like that took me 40 minutes and it was really helpful. I can't sit there for 40 minutes and just wait. You know, like I can practice patience, but man, that's, you know, I'd be like, hey, go do that at home and report back because we just don't, you know, we don't have time to do this. But the bot can be like, I got all the time in the world. Walk me through it. And then it can be supportive at the end, not sycophantic, but it can be like, you know, you've got it right. And it can correct people when they don't. And so this is where, you know, right now, I would say that the future is now in terms of, you know, where we can start to make these hybrid clinics where it's a combination of an expert who's delivering evidence-based treatment, but also with the teaching assistant, right? Something that's also approachable, right? I can now only imagine how many of my patients were just afraid to tell me like they didn't understand what I said because I'm the doctor, I'm the professor or whatever. Well, there's a very, it's not lateralized, but it's a, it's not even democratized. I can't think of the right word, where it's, They're at the same level. The bot isn't like coming from up high like a professor might. And as much as I try to say, you know, tell me if you don't understand something, there's still this inherent hierarchy in this power structure. So the bot is much less of a powered, you know, like it seen as an empowered thing where it can be like, hey, just tell me what's going on, you know, no pressure. And we're finding that that is extremely helpful for people to just really lay it all out there.
Yeah, and it's really important to spread this message because a lot of the time we hear all the negative stuff about AI and all the potential bad things it can do, but this is a prime example of how useful it can be and how useful it can be with humans as well. You know, the hybrid method, it's not like it's going to come, it might do, but right now it's not complete. You're not saying it's completely replacing you as the expert and as the therapist, but it's helping the patients and the people in the meantime when they can't access you, because obviously you have your own limited time. You can't be at 100 places at once in 100 different contexts yet anyway.
Right.
So this is the best alternative, right?
Yeah. And it's also really freeing for me because I can spend the time putting together really good modules for people that aren't just trained on the internet. And then we can be delivering new content that's timely and topical every week. You know, we even did one. So for example, recently we did one on information anxiety when a lot of my patients, they were just glued to the internet because of some recent events. And so we could help. We're like, okay, let's get a module. And we got a module out in 3 days, you know, because I, you know, I've had 20 years of experience working with this and I can say, okay, let's get all of this together. I record it, I get it out, and then they can access it right away. So, you know, that's really helpful to be able to be freed up to be creating, you know, really, you know, evidence-based and grounded content based on my clinical and my science work. So, and the where the bot can be helping people walk through the content.
Mm, yeah, sounds awesome. And as a few ending philosophical questions, some more broad questions for you, Judd. If you could give your 20-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be and why?
I would say, don't underestimate the power of curiosity.
Very, very good. And yeah, the listeners will appreciate that one. Next one is, do you believe in God?
Well, it depends on how you define God. As a separate higher being looking down on us, no. But there's certainly something really mystical and magical that's probably beyond a lot of human comprehension. And I'm totally into that.
Yeah, definitely. And what is the meaning of your life?
If I could reframe that to say what brings meaning, if that's, is that
what
you're asking?
Yeah.
You know, honestly, and I don't want this to sound too crazy, but like to be of service, I have not found anything more rewarding than being of service. Full stop.
Is that just like helping others and improve, like helping them benefit themselves and their lives? Is that how you define that? Yeah.
So both clinically, but even, you know, in teaching students and supporting my students and postdocs in my lab, you know, just helping, you know, like when we're all in it together, working to make the world a better place, like there's no better thing.
And I assume the default mode network is probably turned off in those scenarios, right? Because you're not thinking of yourself as much. If you're giving service to others and teaching students, I guess that's an example of that, right?
I would guess I could give my default mode network a rest. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, is that the case when you teach people or when you're helping people, you're not thinking of yourself, right? So that is not being triggered. Yeah.
And I would say, and anybody can look at their own experience to see if this is true for them. The more I get out of my own way, the more others benefit. When it's about me standing up, giving some lecture or teaching or expounding upon something, that's when things are going to be guaranteed to fall flat.
Yeah. And do you think aliens exist?
Probably.
I mean, do you think like statistically they just have to?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Judson Brewer, ladies and gentlemen. Judd, I really, really appreciate this one. This was really good. And thank you for the insights. I need to keep being interested and curious and less dopaminergic, I think. So yeah, I think there's a lot of insights the audience can take. I really appreciate it. What are you currently working on?
The big thing that I'm currently working on is our Going Beyond Anxiety program. So if anybody's interested, it's, you know, I think the website's just goingbeyondanxiety.com. They can check out and see what we're up to. And also, we've got a bunch of free resources on my Dr. Judd website as well. Folks are looking to see what we've done in the past.
Perfect. I'll leave the links to those in the show notes below. Thank you so much, Judd. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
If you've made it this far, you're likely not just a listener you're ready to be the host. You felt that sense of intimacy and connection with our guest today, and you would like to get the same on your own show and start your own dream show. But you're worried about landing dream guests and all the complications and the mess that is often spoken about when starting your own podcast from scratch. You think starting a podcast requires a huge budget and a whole team, right? That is absolute nonsense. My Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is the ultimate key to skipping the outdated advice and building a high quality, high impact show, even for under $100. It provides the proven strategies and AI templates that I use to this day that you will be able to use to reclaim your time and creative control. And this is a strictly limited opportunity. Don't dilly-dally because there's limited spaces. We've already got one student, Rob, who's joined. That means there's only a couple more spaces to get the Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint course half price. And you need to act very, very fast because this is a limited offer and you're very, very early. So if you want to get the early bird discount like Rob has and get the results by watching the course that goes through the exact step-by-step blueprint that I use to this day to create these episodes that you've just watched and get the success and become Europe's fastest growing under 21 podcaster, and also join live weekly calls with me and use the AI templates and email templates that I use every single day to get the results and just get all my secrets without getting any of the mistakes and failures that I've made, then top link in the description is for you. And if you're ready to launch your own show and get personalized one-to-one help from me and copy my blueprint, which no other podcaster has shared, then I'll see you there. I'm rooting for you. Goodbye. Hope you enjoyed the episode too.